Travolting presents Bobbin for Robin. Hosted by Jeff Sweeney and Stuart Elmore. Covering Awakenings. Enjoy the episode.
I'm awake. Jesus.
Homie. Homie, you have to know that being alive.
I'm trying to do a Mark Simpson. I can't do it.
I thought you were doing an RFK Jr.
No. No, RFK Jr. That's my RFK Jr. If you're awake now.
All right. We're awake.
Yes.
Because we're covering Awakenings.
Yes. I was really trying to do.
Did you like that?
That was very good.
Shake your hand for me. Thank you.
The thing about this movie is that I want to emphasize first and foremost that I do like this movie, but it is very funny that this is like a movie that ends with Marge Simpson walking in a room and like telling Robin Williams, here's the theme of this movie. Julie Kavner, very good actress.
Yeah.
She's very good in this. She is very good in a multitude of things.
Yeah.
This is My Life, a Nora Ephron film. It's like a leading role from her. She's incredible. However, I do think that Marge Simpson casts such a large shadow over her career that you do have a moment every scene of this movie that she walks in where you're just a little bit like, Marge?
Well, like the thing is like she's not talking with her Marge voice in this movie.
But though. She just kind of still sounds like Marge. She's not doing the voice.
A little bit. I've just always been curious if like, if you've been using that voice for so long, does it just naturally take over? Like, I think about that with, like, Seth MacFarlane. But the only thing he has the benefit of is doing multiple voices. Mm-hmm. You know, like, he does multiple voices on Family Guy. But well, I would imagine.
So does Julie Kavner. She plays Marge, and then she also plays Patty and Selma, who have the same voice, just smokier.
Well, exactly. So, like, that's not really a challenge. I just wonder if it's, like, you know, imagine Seth MacFarlane being, like, can I have your date of birth, please? Like, well, yeah, it's November 5th, night,
and it's like... It insisted upon itself.
You're like, why are you talking like that? So sorry.
It just came out of recording from
Griffin. So.
Yeah.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Travolting Presents Bobbin for Robin. Thank you for joining us for our episode, The Awakenings. Last week, you heard...
Cadillac Man,
which we had a very long and thorough discussion about.
Yeah, we were very deep. We went deep into Cadillac.
Went very deep into Cadillac.
Crisp
Man.
40 minutes, I think.
But now we're back into the Robin heyday period after that little short stint of Cadillac Man. It should be noted that like Cadillac Man, as I kind of phrased it, that's like a movie that like he filmed during his like Dead Poets High Rise. Like it wasn't like going off the coattails of that movie.
No, he's still, I mean, he continues to try and do this back and forth between like comedy and drama.
Yeah.
Between like the Robin Williams you know and the Robin Williams you love.
Yeah. Actually, like you kind of went... aimed me at playing one of my clips a little early here because there's actually
good like that. Clip.
Yeah, this is a very good segue. You know, at this point, like Robin is being thought of by the media as being more of a serious actor now, which is kind of funny because everyone knows that Robin's funny, but now they see him doing all these like dramatic pieces and they're like, what's your plan here, buddy? Like, you're good at it, but like, what's your plan? Where are you going from here? So I'm just going to play this quick little interview clip with Robin for The Awakenings.
Now.
Yeah, really. I'm quitting. I'm getting out of here. You'll be all on your back.
Yeah, but it's like that.
You're getting really good, obviously, at this serious business. I mean, we know you're funny, but I mean...
Serious business.
I mean, you're getting an Academy Award nomination, or you should, for this.
You never know.
You got it for Dead Poets Society.
That's a good thing.
You
know,
you're doing great in the serious world.
It's a good... In the serious world.
In the serious
Welcome
world.
Welcome to the serious world. Today, serious things. Problems.
We'll
Why?
Read books together.
Read serious things. Remember, do not watch this show and operate heavy machinery. I do that because it's just examining other aspects to try and, you know, keep finding, pushing the envelope. It's It's almost like, you know, Chuck Yeager. Chuck, I'm pushing the emotional envelope, trying to find those areas which keep changing people's perceptions so you're not categorized as any one thing. The little wacky furry zany guy to try something else.
So, yeah, like even just then, like that's a quick little... I wanted to play that clip because I think it's so funny the way the interviewer is like, you're getting really good at this serious stuff.
Yeah.
He's just like,
and Robin's like, how do I answer that? So he just like starts making fun of it.
Yeah, exactly. It's like serious business.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think Robin is, you know, he's a true, you know, he obviously is aware of the business aspect and he, you know, has a certain degree of, you know, humor about the whole thing. But I do think he's a true artist who cares about his craft.
Yeah.
And to him, like, pitching this as, I mean, even when we discuss it, like, I think if you know, you were here and we were like, yeah, you're kind of doing this dance back between comedy and drama, I'm sure he would, you know, he would kind of agree that was what he was going for. But also, like, to him, it's much more, I'm just trying to do new, interesting things.
Yeah.
It's less about maintaining that back and forth and more things that interest me.
Yeah.
And things that interest me happen to be dramatic and comedic.
Yeah. So this Awakenings was released on this was released December 22nd, 1990. Oh, so it kind of marketed as like sort of Christmas time holiday movie. It's kind of interesting.
It's like a good Christmas drama. It's an Oscar season movie.
It is an Oscar season movie for sure. This comes out December 22nd, 1990. I'm curious, like we haven't covered you yet. When does The Fisher King release? I don't think it was that far after, was it? It was released September 27th, 1991. So like 10 months later.
Yeah.
Okay. I only say that because like as I was reading the book, going through Robin's piece on Awakenings, just to kind of a little context corner here. So obviously like this part can kind of go without saying that at the time of Awakenings, Robin is at like a very hot streak point in his career. He's gotten the Oscar nomination for Dead Poets. He's already had another Oscar nomination for Good Morning Vietnam, and Awakenings is kind of seen as like a surefire hire for Robin. This movie is directed by Penny Marshall.
Yes, her third film.
Her third film.
And her immediate follow-up to Big.
Yes, I think that's the more important part, like, because... Yeah. Do you count like her first film? What was that Whoopi Goldberg movie that
Jumpin'
she did?
Jack Flash.
Jumpin' Jack Flash.
Of course, I... count Jumping Jack Flash, a movie that you look at the poster and you're like, oh, this must be some silly comedy about, you know, Whoopi Goldberg being young at heart, similar to Big. And then you read the synopsis is a 1986 spy comedy film.
Oh my gosh, that's gonna be cool.
I'm sure it's good, or at least entertaining.
It doesn't have a great rating on IMDb, but maybe. But of course, you know, she is titularly Laverne.
She is the Laverne.
Titular Laverne from Laverne and Shirley, as many people know and love. But yeah, this is her follow-up movie to Big, where I think that's another movie where she directed an Oscar-nominated performance.
Yeah, she gets Tom Hanks' first Oscar nomination.
Yeah.
It's funny when you think about Tom Hanks, like... what he's known for now, like his kind of reputation, that his first Oscar nomination is for a comedy where he plays, you know, that's one of those movies where sometimes the Oscars, they nominate someone and it's like obvious. Like, yes, that is
it's a their turn nomination.
Not even that, but just like you want, like, this is an actor in a serious movie delivering an incredible performance. And he's like, of course.
Yeah.
Big is like, it's one of those, you can't deny this performance nominations.
Yeah.
Like, this isn't the type of, you know, movie that they're typically going to nominate Best Actor for.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just like, the performance is so incredible that you can't deny it. Mm-hmm. It breaks out of that mold. It's similar to, like, Johnny Depp in the first Pirates of the Caribbean movie. Like, you're not typically nominating Jack Sparrow from Pirates of the Caribbean, right, The Curse of the Black Pearl for an Oscar.
Sure.
You watch that movie and you're just like, this is undeniable.
Yeah.
Like, of course we're nominating this.
Yeah.
And a lot of that credit, I think, goes to how Penny Marshall, you know, maneuvers Hanks in Big.
Yes, because she works very well with actors. And I think when I was reading the book, Penny Marshall, she had a few talks with other people. I think this was originally supposed to be, if I'm remembering this correctly, I think this was originally supposed to be a Spielberg project, actually.
Sounds like something he would attach himself to.
Right. But then I think the year 1990 and 91 was like a very busy year for Spielberg. So he had to back out. But I know Penny Marshall did like go around and ask, like, I think maybe Barry Levinson, maybe Pete Weir. But I know she talked around about asking, like, how do I use Robin Williams in my movie? Because this role for Robin, well, let me quickly finish up the context and we'll get into this. But Robin being on this hot streak, this is getting towards the tail end of Robin's New York streak.
Yeah.
As we talked about before, when he's doing Dead Poets Society, he does Moscow on the Hudson, Seize the Day, Best of Times, Cadillac Man, Awakenings, even further into Dead Again and Fisher King. These are all movies he's doing as he's staying in New York. With his second wife, he just recently married Marcia. And so this, and then I think Fisher King are going to be like the last two major projects he does in New York before he moves back to San Francisco. And I want to point that out because...
New York.
Right.
Baby.
Because I think Robin, it's noted as a pretty hefty moment in Robin's career where he kind of goes back to the LA Hollywood mold and not sort of the New York day-to-day job mold. Because in New York, you know, he's getting these calls to work on a lot of these projects, and a lot of them are like, hey, like, Robin's in New York. We're shooting this in New York. This is kind of a perfect
segue. I mean, you can basically like kind of do that jump just when you just look down his filmography, and this is the specific period where he's doing Dead Poets Society, Cadillac Man, Awakenings, Dead Again, Fisher King.
Yeah. These are all like happening in,
I mean, Dead Again is set in LA, but like, we'll talk about that later.
Yeah.
But like you said, but there's like a specific kind of movie that he's working in at this time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the next thing he does, Hook.
Yeah.
And then after Hook, Aladdin, Toys, Mrs. Doubtfire, like he kind of like takes a step up, I would say, in terms of the scale of project he's
attached to. He takes a step up in terms of value. Like, Robin Williams is worth a lot more money. Yeah. I'll just say money.
But I would say those all, if you kind of like look at New York and LA as like the yin and the yang of the film industry, especially at this time, where LA is the very like commercial side and New York is the more indie vibe.
Yeah.
And like that's not a one for one equation. So, you know. But that's kind of the idea.
Yes. Yeah.
And he's working in that. And these are not indie movies, but he's working in that like smaller character focused space.
I was going to say,
he goes back
to
LA.
Yeah.
He's in the bigger Hollywood. Hook is a massive production. That's a huge movie.
Yeah. I think you hit the nail right on the head there, where it's like, these aren't indie movies, but they're like very small character.
They're character focused.
They're character focused driven. They're not high, super high concept films. Like, even like, again, we'll talk about when we get to it, but like the Fisher King, if I'm not mistaken, like that's like Terry Gilliam's like least like whimsical big budget special effects.
It is, yeah.
It's the least one that he's probably done in his entire career. So it just goes to show like those are the types of projects he's more so focusing on. So Penny Marshall, Awakenings, actors. So Robin Williams, I think he's one of the earliest hires onto this movie. Robin read Oliver Sacks' book. This is based off of a true story written by a book of Oliver Sacks. I just realized that Angelica and I were watching this last night, and she actually has one of Oliver Sacks' books. It's not Awakenings.
Oh, cool.
It's the one that he wrote about. I'm trying to think of the name of the book, but it's the one that talks about the relationship dementia and Alzheimer's patients have with music. Because Oliver Sacks... I didn't do too much of a deep dive on Oliver Sacks, but I can go on like a mini context corner of Oliver Sacks if you have anything to add as well.
No, just go into the Oliver Sacks stuff.
Just that Oliver Sacks, he was a clinical researcher doctor who did go to med school. He did bounce around to a few different like hospitals and clinics doing more of a research background. He wrote Awakenings, I want to say in the 70s, talking about his time working at this mental institution in New York.
And where in New York?
The Bronx.
The Bronx, baby!
Listen, there's five boroughs.
There's, five boroughs.
There's five boroughs.
Queens, Brooklyn,
Manhattan,
Staten Island,
The Bronx.
That's a fist, baby. Give me the, yeah.
There we go. We didn't miss a fucking
God,
beat.
God, he needs to secure the support of all five boroughs.
We didn't miss a fucking beat on that. And so, but yeah,
what if he's in the hospital in this movie and they're like, Dr. Sayer, you have a new patient. And he's like, oh, who's the patient? They're like, it's kind of a big deal.
Oh shit. That's the old one. That's the old
one. Stuart, you've got to lock in. There you go. Yeah. And you just hear this. And he goes, John Gotti walks in the room.
Let me tell you something. Okay. New York is the best fucking city in the world.
I got a neurodegenerative disease.
Oh my God.
I had encephalitis back in 1927, huh?
Eh?
You know what I'm talking about, huh?
Hey.
All right.
Enough about Gotti.
So, but yeah, and he works particularly with a group of patients that survived an illness that was predominant all over Europe and the United States.
I should watch that original Gotti movie. Anyway, continue.
Called encephalitis lethargia.
Mm-hmm.
I think I pronounced that right. Which was a disease that I'm going to get into this a little bit later because I did a deep dive into this disease and it's very fascinating, the history of it. But yeah, a lot of these patients who had this disease back in, I think it was present around the time of 1917 to 1939 or 1934. The first cool like thing I'll mention is like after 19, whichever year it was before like the last patient was diagnosed, it just goes away. It's gone. Nobody knows what happened. There wasn't a cure or a vaccine made for it. It just kind of like went away. But anyway, like half the people that got this disease started getting like flu-like symptoms. And then if they would survive that period of the disease, it would seem like they got better.
Yeah.
But then like weeks after, they start noticing like neurodegenerative symptoms. They'd start like feeling like their limbs are locking in. They wouldn't be able to speak. Their eyes would get locked into a certain place. They couldn't move until eventually they get sort of frozen in this sort of catatonic statue. Now, it's important to note that these are not per se like comatose patients.
Yeah.
And I think it's a very large distinction to make that's so important because I watched this movie and like there is a view of this movie where it's like this is the doctor who resurrects coma patients movie.
Yeah.
And that is kind of like misleading because this is a very narrow specific disease that has a follow-up symptom of kind of like locked-in syndrome.
Yeah.
These are not brain-dead patients. These are not comatose patients or not even like schizophrenic catatonia patients. This is a very specific, narrow view of patients who are all like kind of aware, which is sort of the thing that this movie talks about in the beginning, but they just have this neurodegenerative brain disease that keeps them from being able to use their body. So, but Oliver Sacks writes a book about it. He has this whole experiment in the year 1969. He goes forward and writes many other nonfiction books about his time in different clinics. I'm going to play this really quick clip.
Yeah.
Oliver Sacks talking about some of the work he did that follows into the movie.
Life.
These days, a county hospital in Brooklyn is serving as a movie set for a film about those famous patients and the famous doctor. Penny Marshall is directing Robert De Niro and Robin Williams, who plays a rumpled, slightly eccentric, very familiar physician.
No, I'm not conscious of the way I stand or move or mannerisms. And then
you should see him with the patients. It's amazing. They love him. I mean,
they want to take care of him.
Yeah, they want to take care of him. You go visit when you go on hospital rounds with him. He's basically, they're going, hey, what? Don't do that. And they want to make sure that he's all right, that he's, you know, fix your tie.
What do you think his gift is?
It's weird because, you know, from talking to him, he can be, oh, good. Oh, well, oh, very good. But then he's like a laser sometimes because he can get inside him and really become so precise on things that it's frightening. I mean, that he can just, he zeroes in on something and becomes so focused. and then finds out the deepest part of it.
So that's just Robin talking about working with Oliver Sacks. Oliver Sacks was on set every single day for the production. I think if you look up on DB, he is like credited as a writer, notably just for writing the book. He didn't have any hand in the screenplay. But he was on set every day as a consultant, which I think is great for this kind of movie. Because not only is this guy just writing like, he's not writing like a fictional story about his life. He's writing about an actual thing that happened.
Yeah.
And he's there every day, like helping the production go through.
So, yeah, I'm sure having Sacks on set is extremely beneficial.
Yes.
For Robin and for the production. This movie also has the benefit of, you know, the adaptation of his book is written by Steve Zayon, screenwriter on the film, who's like kind of the cream of the crop when it comes to like adapted screenplays in Hollywood.
Yeah. Yes, yes, yes.
We talked about him before on the show a few years ago. He directed A Civil Action.
Oh,
I remember that.
No shit. I missed that connection.
But this is one of his earliest screenplays. And he gets this when the movie is still a Spielberg project.
Damn, this guy has done a lot.
But like you'll note, he's mostly like an adaptation guy.
Yes.
He adapts this. Spielberg hires him off of this for Schindler's List, which he writes. Clear and Present Danger, story for Mission Impossible. And he does the Civil Action in there. And then, you know, Gangs of New York, Scorsese, All the King's Men, which is that, I believe.
The
Sean Penn remake of the book. The Irishman, Moneyball, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. A very, you know, very respectable career of adaptations.
He is the adaptation guy.
Because, like, I read the Irishman book, which is, like, basically just an Irishman's, like, kind of ramblings to a reporter.
Yeah.
And the fact that he makes that concise and incredible of a movie out of that book is remarkable.
Yeah.
Because like those are the guys like, you know, I was in town and then Sonny Gambino walks in, but then they shot him and like that's kind of the vibe of the book.
Yeah,
it's better than that, I should say. But like, the making that movie, that screenplay out of that book is really impressive work.
Yeah.
And you know, this is a nonfiction book that this is based on.
Just
a memoir.
I was going to say, like, when I heard that this was like a nonfiction book about a summer of medical research going on where they had a breakthrough in a case, I was thinking like, oh, that's interesting. Because this reads like it was probably a book written in the style of like, patient X took this dose. Patient X 2 days later woke up. Like, but actually, like, the reason why Oliver Sacks' books become so popular as they are is because he writes these nonfiction books sort of in a very narratively style is how it sounds. And he writes with, people talk about Oliver Sacks' books. Like, I think, has he won, like, prizes for his, like, writings? I think he has.
I'm sure he's gotten something, right?
Like, I don't know if he's won, like, a Pulitzer, but I feel like he's, like, at that level of accolades in terms of just his writing alone. And so he awarded Lewis Thomas Prize for writing about science. There are a lot of writing prizes for like writing about nonfictional subjects, but they're so popular because they aren't as like clinically scientifically focused as you might think they would be.
Yeah.
I kind of bring up in the style, like, have you read like, any like Neil deGrasse Tyson's like, not super in-depth books, but like there's one he writes like Astrophysicist on the Go or something like that.
Yeah, Astrophysics for Dummies, more or less.
It's something kind of like along those lines. Like I imagine something like that where it's like take like a very complicated subject, but write it in a way that like a wide audience can
digest. A normal person could understand.
Yeah, and I think that's what Sacks is primarily known for in a lot of his writings. So to that very degree.
Like knowing that going into this movie, that like it's based on kind of just this doctor's memoirs, was very beneficial to me because I think we talked about this before on our Extraordinary Measures episode.
I wanted to see when you were going to bring that up.
No, that movies about this specific like medical drama genre has like the potential to get a little dodgy.
Yeah.
Specifically when it's dealing with like mental illness, which this is not necessarily a mental illness. But like Extraordinary Measures, a movie we talked about, like, that's based on a true story, but it has kind of like this weird, like, almost like apology to Big Pharma aspect to it.
Yes, you're right, because like that is a movie where it's like they give like a very, very, very subtle wink and a nod to like the bad Big Pharma overlurking shadow figure in the background, but they never like, but this movie, the first scene, they describe like the garden.
Yeah.
And I'm just sitting here like, wow. Okay. Yeah. Like we're getting off on that foot on this movie.
And like, also that, you know, there are some fictional movies that will deal with like, this person has this disease and this doctor finds a miracle cure for it. Mm-hmm. And we're going to bring them back. And it's all about, you know, hope and life and all that stuff. And there's something inherently kind of icky to that when it's fictional to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas this being like a true story in, in the truest sense of the word.
Yeah.
Makes it a lot easier to swallow and a lot more. You know, you feel a lot more watching it.
I was very skeptical when I heard like the premise of this being, it's based on a true story. It's about a guy who brought comatose patients like back to life. And I thought, get the fuck out of here.
But
like,
knowing that it actually happened.
But it actually happened. Yeah. And this guy has actual like tapes of people.
Yeah.
And they show like actual, I think the year they were doing this interview on Dr. Sachs during the Awakenings, there were, at that point, 1991, only two living encephalitis lethargia patients left alive. Yeah. So, like, there, and now it's 2025, there are no more patients left alive anymore that have this disease, which, again, I'll get to that, the craziness of it later. One more clip I want to play as it relates to Oliver Sacks and Robin Williams. This is a Charlie Rose interview.
Yes.
The notion of the Awakenings, and what do you think Robin Williams, you've got to know him well. You're going later this evening, you're going to be honored. He's being honored by some academy here in New York. You two are friends?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Tell me about the friendship. Because he played you, obviously.
Right. Well, we spent a lot of time together at first, and we hung out together. We went to see patients. And I thought he was just, you know, a nice, brilliant guy. I didn't realize that I was, in fact, the subject of unceasing, relentless, and at the same time, very, very sympathetic observation until I was having a conversation with him. And I got into one of my odd gestures, such as
you see like
there.
This, yes.
Like that. I seemed to get into
And all
things.
Of a sudden, he's watching.
Yeah. Well, no, he was in the same gesture, and he wasn't imitating me. But by that point, he
was
had,
becoming you.
Well, exactly. He had my gestures. He had my opinions, my wishes, my regrets, my interests, my memories. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was an extraordinary sort of identical twin. At that point, we felt we had to make some distance between us.
And if people look up like an image of what Dr. Sachs looks like, I think it'll be very clear and easy why Robin Williams is such an easy typecast for this guy. Oliver Sachs is like described as being like 6'4", and he's got this big jolly
Bushy
Santa Claus beard and just kind of.
It's funny that Robin later in his life will be known for having a big bushy beard, but doesn't in this movie.
Yeah, and so, but this all carries into my next little thing about Robin in particular in this movie. So he gets casted pretty quickly in the process for this movie. And then when they're looking for who's going to play Leonard Lowe, I couldn't find a lot of information as it relates to how Robert De Niro got into this role.
I could tell you how.
Yeah.
So De Niro is originally looked at for Big. He's supposed to be Big in the movie. But the studio is hesitant to have De Niro just play in an out-and-out comedy like that.
Mm-hmm.
That outrageous of a comedy. He's obviously done comedy at this point in his career.
Yeah.
So Penny Marshall switches to Hanks, who is, you know, a comedic actor at that point mostly.
Yeah.
And brings him in, but she wants to work with De Niro again. And this is her follow-up film, and I think he just kind of re-enters the mix naturally that way.
Okay, got it. Yeah. So, and Robin had even said, like, when they told him, like, okay, you're going to be playing opposite of Robert De Niro, Robin immediately is nervous at this prospect.
Yes.
The first thing he asks, like, Penny Marshall is, like, okay, how are we going to do this without Robert De Niro blowing me out of the water? Yeah. So he says, like, I'm not going to let that happen. Number one, he's comatose for half the movie, so you don't got to worry about that. But also, number two, this movie focuses not particularly on each of these characters as individuals, but rather the brawn that they kind of make as it goes along. And I'm thinking like, okay, but this seems very much like a Robin Williams vehicle, even though like the poster, Robert De Niro, Robin Williams, the opening text, Robert De Niro, Robin Williams, like this is
that 45 minutes before De Niro, like,
yeah, but it is
actually in the movie.
It is framed as a two-hander movie, and it kind of, we watch it. It is, but it takes a minute to get to that two-hander part.
Yes.
When it gets to that two-hander part and we have Robert De Niro and Robert Williams together, I mean, dude, they describe themselves as like, you know, being good friends on set, where people were thinking like, oh, it's De Niro. He's played a lot of like dramatic actors. Yeah. He's going to be like very straight laced on set. And Robin makes the joke is like, Robert De Niro can clear an eye line from here all the way to Tasmania.
Yeah.
But that, and they were,
De Niro at this point in his career is like the actor.
Yeah.
It's like if you say,
how many
actor,
nominations?
There's a pretty good chance that De Niro is going to come down.
How many nominations?
Let's see how many nominations.
How many nominations does he have at this point? Minus this one that he's going to get. Because I'm
looking it up.
I think he has like four at this point. I'm not
he
even
has
including
such a big Wikipedia page. Jesus Christ. Okay, here we are. So he was nominated in 74 for The Godfather Part II, 76 for Taxi Driver, 78 for The Deer Hunter, 80 for Raging Bull.
So it has four.
He has four nominations at the point. It's
two
been
wins.
10 years since he was nominated and won for Raging Bull. But then he's going to get nominated for this. He's going to get nominated next year for Cape Fear. And then he's going to go on a 20-year sabbatical from getting nominated for Oscars. And then he's going to get nominated again for Silver Linings Playbook. And then again for Killers of the Flower Moon, a movie we covered on this show.
Unreal. Unreal. And so Robin and Robert De Niro, obviously, like, on the surface level, you think could not be two different people. But they got along very well on set. There were moments where Robin is trying to kind of do a little shtick during a scene and he would just make Robert De Niro laugh to a degree that his character couldn't naturally laugh. And Penny Marshall had to kind of reel him in. One more clip I'm going to play just regarding Robert De Niro and Robin Williams.
First, assume that they'd like to see the things that I like and they don't.
Robin's very funny on the set. I mean, he likes to concentrate, too. He's very serious about what he does. But at the same time, you know, he'll joke around between takes because in movies there's a lot of waiting. And he's quite something, very, very amazing, really funny.
Mark. I'm sorry. A library. Let's call it that. I mean.
Well, <why not? laughs> that sounds expensive.
Expensive, expensive. Let's go with it. It's an idea before its time, but let's try it. I've wanted to talk like this for the entire movie. I want to be an old Jewish doctor. Lenny and I have an idea.
Yeah, it keeps your creative juices running. It's just, you know, not something we can't use in the film, but we certainly appreciated it being around the film.
Robin has that reputation of being like one of those guys who can like break through anyone.
Break the ice
and like,
easily. Yeah.
De Niro does not, he does not have a bad reputation in Hollywood by any stretch of the imagination. He does have a reputation of like, he's very serious, takes his job very seriously.
Yeah. I just imagine
he shows up.
He's the guy that's like, okay, Bob, we want you to be on this mark. You come over here. He's like, okay. Like, just like,
I mean, you watch any interview with Robert De Niro nowadays.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
They're the most entertaining things ever.
Yeah.
Because like, they'll be like, so Robert, tell us about this movie. And he's like, so this movie's about a gangster. But you know who's a real gangster? Donald Trump. We got to get him out of office. Like, I'm telling you, watch any interview with De Niro. It takes him under a minute to bring up Trump every time. It's crazy.
Fantastic.
You really got to, it's very funny.
Very, very good.
But like, when I, similar to the medical nature of this movie, when I'm reading what this movie is before we watch it,
mm-hmm.
I see like Robert De Niro playing essentially like Parkinson's patient.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, uh-oh. And his first scene in the movie, like he's just kind of sitting there and he has his jaw open. He's like kind of like crumpled up.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just like, oh no.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is such a trap for, I mean, you hate to cite this movie necessarily, but like Tropic Thunder is just like kind of the perfect parody of the bad version of this performance.
Yeah.
Like very simple Jack nature.
Yeah.
Where it's just like a big actor can get really convinced of their talents.
Yeah.
and decide, oh, I'm going to play a mentally handicapped person, or just even a handicapped person in general. And it can, you know, be really dodgy. You know, Rain Man has, its reputation's kind of fallen recently because of the Hoffman performance and that.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on your view of Forrest Gump, similar story. It's like, it's a trap that actors can fall into a lot, is that they almost make like these people more gimmicky than mm-hmm. real. I do think, and it's big credit to Penny Marshall. Like, I want to bring back to what I said earlier about Big, where she really calibrates Hanks in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think she has a strong calibration in this.
Mm-hmm.
That De Niro manages to thread this really thin needle
mm-hmm.
to making this performance work.
Yeah.
Because you watch like the scene, especially later in the movie when like he has to walk across the room fully like collapsing into himself.
Yeah.
That's really hard as an actor to do without being funny.
Yeah.
Unintentionally funny.
Right.
But like you as a viewer know, this is Robert De Niro. He's fine. He's mm-hmm. doing this.
Yeah.
But I think the movie manages to make it work. It's one of the few instances I've seen where like this really works.
Well, I was thinking like, you know, why this role, De Niro? Like, why does he want to do this role? And it's like, you just mentioned, like, it's been 10 years since he's going to get nominated since Raging Bull. And I thought, why is he doing this like weird nonfiction Oscar bait drama? And then I realized 2 years prior to this is My Left Foot.
Yeah.
With Daniel Day-Lewis. And I can't help but feel like there's like a little bit of that in the background of some people's mm-hmm. minds. It's like, oh, this is going to be like our Oscar movie. My Left Foot just came out and Daniel Day-Lewis got an Oscar for that one. And that being said, I think two things I want to mention here. Number one, that what this movie gets sort of a very thin zone of creative license, only in the sense that, like, as I mentioned earlier, that this is a very specific and narrow disease.
Yeah.
This is not somebody with like, well, because here's the thing, like, you mentioned this where it's like, and I think you're maybe alluding to this, where it's like Robert De Niro in the story, like his character Leonard Lowe, gets the disease when he's like, what? And he's like, he's 20 or something like that. But, and then he's aged like 30 years. He's been stuck in like a statue stage. And there is a moment when he wakes up and you almost get a little worried he's going to do this little shtick of like acting like a kid in an adult's body sort of thing, and not in like a dramatic way, but he is able to thread that needle so well.
I think it's because the appeal, like the draw of this movie, is not see Robert De Niro play a handicapped guy.
Yeah.
That's not the point. That's not the selling idea of the movie. But that's also a tragedy in the second half when, you know, the drug stops working.
Yeah.
But it's not like, you know, go see Rain Man. Dustin Hoffman plays a mentally challenged guy.
Which, funny enough,
you'll never see the world until you see through the eyes of Forrest Gump.
Right. That's funny. You mentioned Rain Man. Oliver Sacks also was a consultant for Rain Man as well. But I think it's so important to go back to the nature of this disease, is that they are not like these patients that are being portrayed here, some of which are real patients, by the way. They used real patients as background in this movie because they filmed in a real like mental hospital.
Yeah.
And I think what this is partly at the Penny Marshall's ability and also Robert De Niro's ability, that this is a disease. They're not like mentally handicapped in the sense of like they're like, I'm trying to think of like the way to phrase it, but like this isn't like a mental handicap in the sense that their brain is degenerating at a particular point that makes them, I guess, like neurotypical sort of way.
Yeah.
They're not presenting like a different type of, I guess the way I'm trying to say this is like, if it would be very different if like this was a movie about, like, I'm trying to be very careful how I phrase this, like if it was like somebody with like Down syndrome or like autism or something like that, and it was like a movie about, like, I don't want to say like I don't know, like a experimental
We've
disease.
Cured Down syndrome. Well, like that kind of movie.
I'm trying to think, like, what does that, like, that makes my stomach churn
yeah.
in a way that this movie doesn't
yes.
because they're two different things.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Am I, like, yeah. No, the drug or the disease in this movie is, like, undoubtedly an affliction.
Yeah.
And, like, it's not, there's not, like, it's not a mental disorder that someone lives with. This is a drug, that, this is a disease right. that, like, takes life away.
You have phrased it better than I did. Yes. Yes. Thank you. Yeah.
I knew what you, exactly what you were trying to say.
Yes. Yes. You phrased it better yeah. than I did.
This is just a disease.
This is just...
It's not a disorder. It's a disease.
Yes. And, yeah.
And I think that's why the movie is able to thread that needle.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of the credit has to go to...
Because these people had, like, full normal lives
yes.
before they were afflicted with yes. this. And when they wake up, rather than, like... being from one degenerative state to a more typical degenerative state, it's like they're just back to their normal selves. I mean, when the scene where, like, De Niro, when Robin brings in De Niro's, like, mom, and he's like, I think there's somebody who wants to see you. And De Niro, in kind of his, like, young kid voice, is like, mama. Like, that's a scene that could be very ballsy to try to film in not a way that feels funny, and it isn't funny. Like, it's so, like, heartwarming and heartfelt, which I think is just a testament to how well this movie does.
Yeah.
There's a whole bit I want to get into about the disease itself, but I think that's saved for a little bit later. This is, and it's not really anything necessary to the movie we're talking about. It's just because I did a deep dive on encephalitis lethargica
yeah.
last night, and it's so fucking fascinating, like the whole bit about it. Anyway, shall we get started on, do you have anything else to say before we get into
No, I think we can just start going mode? Through it. I think it was good to kind of luxuriate in pretext for this one.
Yeah.
Because it is really a very simple movie.
Yes.
That I think will...
Like, I was going to say, once we
there's
get
not
to
a
plot,
lot of plot.
When we get to
it.
The plot, you, like, people are going to notice how quickly we move through it. And that's not because the movie is, like, it's a 2-hour movie, but, like, I feel like a lot of the things we're going to talk about, it's like he, like, Robin Williams, who plays,
watch this.
Oh, here we go.
Robin Williams needs a job. He's a medical doctor, or he's a neurologist, gets a job at a mental hospital in the Bronx. Starts investigating the disease all these patients are afflicted with, discovers it's encephalitis lethargica, finds out about a drug that they're using to treat Parkinson's patients, gets the drug, tries it on Robert De Niro. Robert De Niro regains full control of himself and his faculties. They become friends. He cures all the other patients. The drug stops working. They all relapse. But Robin Williams has learned a lot about life and how fragile it is.
There you go.
That's the plot of the movie.
That is the plot of
that
the
is
movie.
The I mean, obviously, I skipped over, like, a lot of specific details.
Yeah.
But that is, it's a very basic story.
Mm-hmm.
It's a story, you know, that it's not, I wouldn't say it's, like, revolutionary or unpredictable by any means.
Yeah.
But I think it's in the simplicity that it works, that it's able to really grab your heartstrings and make you work, like, work on you.
This movie made me cry twice.
Yes, this is such a Stuart cry movie.
Yep.
I mean, it's a sad movie.
Yeah.
By no stretch of the imagination. It almost made me cry.
Almost.
But I'm watching, I'm like, this is Penny Marshall. Like, if Stuart crying is like a basket, this is Penny Marshall just dribbling across the court and just dunking that shit in.
Yeah, it is a very, very
LeBron
Stuart,
James.
Very Stuart
shit.
Sad movie. But Robin Williams plays Dr. Malcolm Sayer, who is sort of a spinoff of Dr. Oliver Sacks. He is looking for a job as a clinical researcher. And he goes to this mental institution and they posted like a job opening for one of their in-house doctors who's more so supposed to be focusing on, like, actually taking care of the patients as opposed to what Williams' character wants, which is more of like a research.
He wants a research position.
And that goes into his character being like Williams plays this role as somebody who's not very good with human connection.
Yes.
That he is very kind of like a little bit of an outsider. And which goes in again into, like, Robin is not funny one time in this movie. I don't think.
No, he has a good joke at the beginning, the opening scene.
What's he?
I know because I wrote it down.
What was it?
So it's in his job interview. It's him and so John Hurd plays like the kind of snivelly doctor in this.
Of course.
It's funny because like that's not an actor that I'm like, not John Hurt, John Hurd.
Mm-hmm.
To be clear. John, who's like not an actor who I would expect that I know their name.
Yeah.
But I'm watching the opening credits of this movie and it's like, you know, Robert De Niro, Robin Williams gets her, and then it says John Hurd, and I'm like, is the dad from Home Alone?
Yeah.
And I don't fucking know how I knew his name.
Mm-hmm.
What else have I seen this fucking guy in?
Well, he's a dad in a lot of other things,
but
I
like,
think, right?
Why do I know John Hurd's name? I would like honestly, if someone could explain to me why I knew that name.
I don't know.
I'm just like really diseased. I think is he also the mayor in Batman Returns? I think he's the mayor in Batman Returns. I'm gonna find out.
Could be.
He's in Big. He is in Home Alone. He's in Home Alone 2. Is he not the mayor in Batman Returns?
I don't think so. Okay.
I'm mixing him up with someone else then.
Anyway,
not really important, but so like he's in this interview and they're like, well, what's the last thing you did? And he said, oh, I spent 4 years trying to extract one like milliliter of myelin out
from
of
an earthworm or something,
out of like 100 pounds of earthworm or something.
Mm-hmm.
And John Hurt says, that's not possible. And Robin quickly snaps and says, oh, I know. That's I proved it. He says, like, that's impossible. He says, I know that. I proved it. I proved that it's impossible. You're like, basically saying he wasted 4 years of his life
yeah.
on something that didn't work.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's a good, like, quick snap.
Starting bit. But After that, I don't feel like he has.
No,
much.
He, like, has a good line delivery every now and again. There's the bit when he's in the restroom with Peter Stormare. He's a little funny.
All I'm saying is, like, this is, like, I think out of all the movies we've talked about with Robin so far, this is the most constrained Robin.
Yes, so far.
I think constrained is probably a bad way to say it. I think it's just the most, like, muted.
Yes.
Like, because Robin is...
He's not doing voices.
Robin, naturally, is a very extroverted guy.
Yes.
He's very all over the place. And he has to play this guy who is very introverted, uncomfortable talking to other people. And, like, just this... I think this might have been, I don't know, but I would suspect to this point, this is probably Robin's most difficult role he's had to do.
Yes.
He does.
He can't use his tricks.
Right. But like it doesn't feel like it's a difficult role to me watching it. It feels like he's just naturally good at this.
Yes.
But I can't help but look at his last few films and be like, I bet this was like kind of hard for him.
Mm-hmm.
Though he has the benefit of having Oliver Sacks on set with him every day
yeah.
to kind of like do a mimic of. But yeah, so they ask him, it's like, well, hey, you were in medical school, right? And you're like, yeah. It's like, well, you had to go do clinicking hours at medical school, so that means you can work at the clinic here. So like, okay, you got the job. So Robin Williams gets the job, and right away he gets shown through this hospital. And this first scene that I think just kind of like pulled me out of like, oh, we're just going to watch a very average medical hospital yeah. drama movie, is they walk through this hospital, see all these people in wheelchairs. A lot of them are catatonic. Some of them are not within control of their faculties. And one of the nurses or aides that's walking them through says, why are all these people here? What are they waiting on? It's like, they're not waiting on anything. And like, this is called the garden.
Yeah.
And like, what does that mean? It's like, cause all we do is we just water and feed them. And it gets blown by so quickly that like you're almost not given any time to react to that line, but holy shit.
Yeah.
Like it's just the most like disregard for human life of like, yeah, I mean, these people, they're just kind of here to rot.
Yes.
And all we do is we just water and feed them.
Yeah. We truly just like,
cause this is also like, this is a mental institution in the 1960s. Which is a whole other basket case of topics and subjects that people could get into about the mistreatment of patients in that time. And even in the mistreatment of patients yeah. onward in today. But even, especially then, it's like, I think like lobotomy still happened around this time, right? When did One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest come out? Like that was in 80.
It's like 70 something.
Right. But that, I think it's a period piece.
Yeah. No, it's around
50s, something like that. Right. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is a period piece in the 50s.
This is definitely well before people, you know, are treating mental illness or chronic disease in a serious way.
Yeah.
Because they call it like, it's like a chronic hospital is seen as like
chronic hospital,
the lesser, the lesser, you know, medical pursuit.
Yes. Yeah. And so, So One Flew Over Cuckoo's Nest was 1963. So just 6 years before this would have happened. So people are still doing like lobotomies on patients. There are still patients getting like electroconvulsive therapy at this time. Like the movie's not interested in that particular side of this sort of subject. It's more interested in the terms of like the medical breakthroughs that are being done for these patients. But that was like a quick almost like it felt like a throwaway line almost that was like, by the way, we understand that a lot of the hospitals in this day and age were like this.
Yes.
And we're probably a lot worse than this, but we're not going to ignore that. Because that's the thing I didn't want this movie to do is just be like, yeah, we're a mental hospital and we do our best to help all our patients. It's like,
this movie is about how most doctors are like, they're here just to, you know, make sure that no one dies and then
about it. So then right away, I think we just go into, he's doing some experiments on patients, right?
Well, he gets a new patient, Lucy, mm-hmm. Played by Alice Drummond.
Yeah.
Who is, I was like, where do I know her from? She's the librarian in Ghostbusters.
I can't believe you pulled that out.
Yeah.
Impressive.
I was just like, I know. She's the one at the beginning who's like in the library and put on the books and the books start moving and then the ghost. Yeah.
But
and she says, my uncle thought he was Saint Jerome. To all the ghost heads out there who, if you're a ghost head and you're listening, get a life, stop saying that the women Ghostbusters are bad. Anyway,
So he's examining Lucy. She's catatonic, unable to move, and he starts to notice that she does respond to certain stimuli.
She drops her glasses.
She drops her glasses.
She leans down to get them.
Yeah, and she leans down to pick them up. This is where he finds out that they do have sort of like a reflex that's built into their consciousness.
Well, it's not reflex, because like John Hurd says, they're reflexes, and Robin's like, they're not reflexes. He's very specifically like, there's a stimuli that is causing like an active choice in their body. It's like a brief awakening moment.
Yes.
Is how he describes it.
Right.
Because a reflex is just like a motor action, but this is not motor. This is mental based.
Right. Because he says it would be a reflex. They were just whacking at the ball.
Yes.
But they're not. They're catching it. There's like a scene where they're like tossing the balls back and forth. And I'm like, how accurate is that? Because, like, it's one thing to, like, jerk out and catch a ball. It's another thing to throw the ball. That's a whole other series of muscle actions you need in order to do that. So I wonder how accurate that would be if patients were actually, like, catching and tossing the ball back and forth. That being said, Robin Williams' character is finding more and more clues and evidence to show that these people are, like, awake inside. Yeah. And that's something that kind of shatters the glass of a lot of the doctors in this hospital, because their whole thought process is, no, these people are asleep.
Most of the doctors still like don't really believe him at the start. They'll like, some of them are interested, but John Hurd specifically is very opposed.
Yeah.
The only person who like really believes him is his nurse.
Played by?
It's me, Marge Simpson.
Yeah, Julie Kavner.
Julie Kavner.
Yeah. And he...
Oh, me.
They start going through the patient's files. This is where we do get a scene where we get introduced to Robert De Niro's character.
Yes.
Playing Leonard Lowe, who is, again, also frozen in a catatonic state. He's not able to move, speak, or do anything. And his mother, who is played by...
Ruth Nelson.
Ruth Nelson.
In her final on-screen performance.
Yes.
Great
role. She did great.
She does really well. This movie, there's a story that was published in Premiere Magazine that is like, it's unclear whether this is true or not. But like it was published around the time of the movie.
I think I know what story you're about
to say. That De Niro wanted Shelley Winters to play his mom in this.
Yes.
And that she came into her audition. She was asked to audition for it.
Yeah.
And she came to the audition and just put her Oscars on the desk and says, some people think I can act. Do you still want me to audition for this?
There's been dispute if this story is actually
the story's real, been told many times. I never knew it was about this movie specifically. It's like in dispute whether that's actually true. But regardless,
it's very funny.
Very funny. Print the legend. I'm going with it. I'm just going to say it. Anyway, Shelley Winters ends up not being the final version of this movie. Penny Marshall finds Ruth Nelson, who was mostly a theater actress. She's 85 at the time she's in this movie.
God damn.
We
even forgot.
Apparently, they could not get her insured.
Interesting.
Because she was
so old.
So old. They didn't care. They cast her in it, and she's incredible.
I think she's really good in this movie, and
she really sells the heartbreak of the whole thing. Specifically, like the kind of messy emotional state when Leonard is awake,
mm-hmm.
and is like starts like pushing her away.
Yeah,
that's a hard, you know, thing for a movie to really capture is that feeling.
Yeah.
Where it's like you want nothing more for your entire life but to have your son back. You get him back and he wants freedom from you.
Yeah.
That sucks. Like that's
it's a hard role to play in the sense that like you are trying to like you don't want the character. This is a thinking in Ruth's performance aspect. You don't want the character to feel like ungrateful that he's woken up. But you also don't want the character to feel totally fine and okay with the fact that he's like going off and doing his own things and doesn't need his mom as much. But I think she performs that very, very well. I mean, the final scene where she says like, you know, back then, like the doctors wouldn't listen to me when I told them my son was suffering and they need to do something. I am telling you now, my son is suffering and you need to do something. Like that scene was so, so good. And the scene, there's a lot. She does really great things in this movie. We forgot to mention that the very beginning scene is actually a prologue of Robert De Niro's character as a little boy playing throughout the streets, carving his name in like a wooden bench. And then the last image is he's sitting on his bed, not moving. And then we cut to modern day. That was a quick little prologue bit in the movie that didn't know if we actually needed that, but I guess it was good to show like this work, pay attention to this kid. Like he's going to be important later. Robin Williams' character does more experiments just to like push the envelope of like how much consciousness is prevalent in these patients. There's one scene where he draws like the tiles on the floor of an unfinished tile floor in the hospital that prevents Lucy from walking all the way to the window. So he's able to like show like, no, like these aren't reflexes. These aren't jerk movements. These are people making conscious decisions, showing that there is a consciousness still alive in there. So, that's where we, oh my God, girl, you are shedding like crazy.
Yeah. This cat is going crazy.
My cat.
I feel like
on my lap.
People should just listen to the show now to hear updates on the cat.
Yes. Piper's doing well. She had a very exciting few days when we moved all the furniture. Ah, hey, why'd you bite me? Anyway. She does that. She loves me, though. I love you. Okay. So it's at this point, Robin and Julie Kavner get together one night, and they are going through all the patients' files.
Yes.
And they find a connection with
Bart Simpson.
Stop.
Not doing well.
They find that a lot of these patients, especially the ones who've been here for a while, all have the same diagnosis of encephalitis lethargica.
Yes.
And so he finds that, and he then goes to the one of
the surviving doctor.
Surviving doctors who treated this illness.
Played by Max von Sydow.
Okay, can I go into an encephalitis lethargica corner?
Can I really quick just say something about Max von Sydow?
Please.
Who plays like...
Max von Sydow!
He's playing an ancient man in this movie.
He's played an ancient man.
I would like
in this
to be
movie.
Very clear. He's playing ancient.
Yes.
This is when does The Exorcist come out? The Exorcist. Yeah, the first one's in 73. Another movie in which Max von Sydow is playing an ancient man. I would like to be clear. He is 60 in this movie. He is 60 when they make this movie. Are you going to bring up this? One of the most like storied careers in the film industry. And you pull up his one scene role in Star Wars The Force Awakens. Yeah, he has traveled very far. He was in... God, what's that?
Without the Jedi,
the Seventh Seal. No balance. Enough of this. A great performance.
This is like, she's always princess to me.
A performance that is so effective that he's like, when Adam Driver is just like, I have known you for my entire life and I am going to kill you. He's like, you might try. And you're just like, yeah, I believe this. Even though you're like, who is this guy? Why is he relevant? And they never explain it.
So good.
The point I'm just trying to make is that he is like playing ancient in this.
Yeah.
In The Exorcist. He's 60 in this movie.
Yeah.
And he is like 43 in The Exorcist.
Yes. So good.
I find it very funny how much he was getting cast as like ancient men when he was relatively young. And then when he actually becomes old, he continues playing ancient men in like Star Wars and Game of Thrones. Anyway, great actor. I'm going to watch Minority Report tonight.
Died 5 years ago.
Rest in peace. So.
Can I go in my encephalitis lethargica corner? So encephalitis lethargica. So as we said at the very top of this, that this is based off of a real book based on real events. So encephalitis lethargica was a real illness that people would get. It started in 19... The first recorded patient, I believe, is described in 1917 by a French neurologist and pathologist. So it was also coined as sleeping sickness or sleepy sickness. Well, what would happen is people would get this disease and they would start getting like flu-like symptoms. Now, there's another flu-like disease, very popular, that a lot of people know about, that's also rampaging through Europe and the entire world between the 1917, all that stuff, called the Spanish flu. So this is kind of being sort of attached to it as sort of a breakaway mutation of the Spanish flu. So people would get this starting off with like flu-like symptoms, and then a lot of those who caught this wouldn't even survive that initial symptomatic stage, caused over like 500,000 deaths just from that alone.
Yeah.
The people who recovered said, you know, they immediately would start feeling better. And then like a few weeks later, I'm trying to think of when exactly it was, but a few weeks later is when they would start to notice like neurodegenerative disease. So they would start by having like stiff muscle movements. Their eyes would get stuck looking at one place. They couldn't say certain words. There were other neurological symptoms also associated with it until eventually they become like frozen and locked in place.
Yes.
And that was sort of seen as them just falling into a permanent coma catatonic state. And nothing was ever thought. They were just shipped to like a mental hospital, basically forgotten about, until thankfully Dr. Oliver Sacks came in and decided to focus more on these patients.
Yeah.
And I think in the movie he describes as there being like, he starts with saying like there's 5 patients here with encephalitis lethargica, but I think there's more. And I think like the movie describes like there's like what, like 10, 15 patients at this hospital with this, like roughly, would you say?
Yeah.
So I looked up an article about this disease to learn like what else had been learned about it. And so I found this article written in October 2024. Weirdly enough, like this disease spanned from like 1917 up until 1930.
Yeah.
And then it just goes away. People stop getting it for some reason. And more research had been done on this movie. And as Dr. Oliver Sacks' research with L-DOPA used for Parkinson's, which does help bring these patients back like awake, But as we'll talk about later in the movie, it comes with other symptoms that can be sometimes would even be described worse than just being in a catatonic state, which we'll get to in the plot in the movie. That being said, after that process, there's been a few other medical research journals written. There's been a few other like experiments run, but like because no one's caught this disease since 1930, like there are no more remaining survivors today. I think the last survivor died in 2012. I could even be wrong about that. It might even be earlier than that, the last surviving patient of encephalitis lethargica. And so very much to that point, like there's not really that much of a push to figure out more of this disease. Yeah. A, because there's no more surviving patients of it, but B, no one's ever really catching this disease anymore. And there's a lot of things written. It's like people thought this was a variation of the Spanish flu, and it wasn't. It actually wasn't a variation of the Spanish flu. People don't know where this came from. They don't know what started this disease.
And they don't know what happened to
it. They don't know what happened to it. And the thought process is like, listen, this is 4 years after COVID. We kind of have an idea where COVID came from, and we were able to, thankfully, in time, build a vaccine to stop that in time. What happens when the next neurodegenerative disease starts coming into town? And we don't have like that much research about it.
Well, it's a good thing that we have a health and human sciences chief who's doing a lot of good jobs with funding. Anyway, let's...
This is a disaster.
Anyway, that's my whole spiel on encephalitis lethargica. I just... Reading that like article sent me into a spiral about like, we got to know more about encephalitis lethargica.
The audience is driving to work who were excited to hear about a Robin Williams movie are now shitting their pants. Thank you, Stuart.
You're welcome.
Anyway, I'm going to kind of just get us to when De Niro wakes up.
Well, so, yeah, then
he goes to...
There's a scene where he goes to a doctor presentation.
Yeah, he hears about a drug called L-DOPA that essentially just, like, stimulates dopamine production. It's being used to treat Parkinson's.
Yeah.
He goes to a conference where there's the chemist who invented the drug, played by Peter Stormare, who just plays, like, a snooty Swede.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Peter Stormare.
Who's just like, I am Peter Stormare.
I'm the chemist. You're the physician.
Peter Stormare, who like, it's kind of funny that he never has played like, as near as I have seen, he's never played just like a nice, amiable guy.
No.
He's always like...
He's always a sniveling dude.
He's this, or he's the in The Lost World getting consumed by the dinosaurs.
Yes.
Or he's in Bad Boys 2 inexplicably.
Isn't he the guy that gets eaten by all like the little baby
the compies.
The compies, yeah.
And then he's in... John Wick 2 as the Russian mobster.
Yes.
I mean, we love Peter Stormare. He's a Yuli in The Big Lebowski, a wonderful actor.
Yeah.
But he just like can't play a chill guy. So it's like high intensity.
Yes.
Because Robin like confronts him in the bathroom. It comes up to him in the bathroom and is like, this drug could like majorly help people. Don't you see? And Peter Stormare's like, I'm the chemist. You're the doctor.
You take the risk.
You deal with that.
Yeah.
And he just like kind of storms off. Peter Stormare is not in the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
But Robin, he gets the drug approved to work on, to try on one patient who's going to be Leonard Lowe.
Yeah.
Because he's played by Robert De Niro and it would be silly to not use it on him.
I'm trying to think like, what if
like he did it on one of the other patients and De Niro spends this whole movie just like sitting in the wheelchair.
Well,
everyone's like, why is he in that?
I do think there is a story reason for it because Robert De Niro is one of the very few patients who has family still alive.
Because he needs family to consent.
Right. And because everybody else is like in their 60s and 70s, Robert De Niro is the only one who's like 50.
Yeah.
And so he still has family like alive that can consent to the procedure. So his mom consents to it and he says, like, do you think this is going to work? And he's like, truly, ma'am, like, I don't know.
Earnestly,
couldn't tell you, chief. I don't know if this is going to do anything. It's just a hunch. And so they start doping him up with L-DOPA.
Yeah, they quite literally dope him up.
They start with like putting like 200 milligrams in orange juice and like feeding it down Robert De Niro. Nothing quite happens. They start upping the dose till they eventually do like over 1,000 milligrams of L-DOPA.
Yeah.
And so it's nighttime in the hospital. Robin Williams is like in his office.
No, he's sleeping next to De Niro.
Oh, that's right. He goes to sleep in one of the patient beds.
The drug doesn't work at the dosage that they're doing. They try increasing the dosage.
Right, yeah.
And then Robin just like breaks into the the chemist room at the hospital and gives him 1,000 milligrams, which is a huge dose.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what the real life things happen in this movie, but if it is the way that this movie is describing, like, talk about, like, you know, physician irresponsibility. Like, he could have, like, any other, like, medical review board would have, like, revoked his license doing something like that. Just putting that out there. I don't mean to be like the sad like old man and be like, you're not supposed to do that.
Yeah.
It's like just in modern day standards, like no medical review board would be like okay with that.
Yeah. You'd be cooked.
I mean, like any other kind of drug trial test, like you could have like OD'd him and killed him.
Yes.
Which is not what his mom's consented for.
So she consented to. But anyway, he falls asleep and he wakes up. The bed is empty. He finds De Niro in another room, like kind of writing his name with a crown.
Yeah. And Robert De Niro turns around and he's still not quite gotten.
He's not 100% back yet.
Not 100% back yet, but he does say like, it's me. And says like, I'm awake. And says, as his heart glows, Elliot says like, does this mean they're coming? And he's like, phone home. And then he shuts the freezer door on him and pretends to cry. E.T., one of the best movies ever. Yeah. No reaction from that from you, Jeff,
it's
whatsoever. Just got nothing. I got nothing.
We're going to talk about this when we get a hook.
Wow, this is a disaster.
All right, anyways.
I was noticing how the Wikipedia synopsis of this movie like skips over like basically the entire middle part of this movie. It's very quickly summarized.
Yeah.
Because the next like 45 minutes are very much just like they're having a good time. He gets the drug at about 45 minutes into the movie.
Yeah, and
the next like 45 minutes to an hour and a half is the drug works. They bring De Niro and all the other patients back.
Yeah.
They all kind of experience the world that they've been missing for upwards of 30 years.
Yeah.
You know, the drug has incredible results.
And there's a point in this movie where they touch on the fact that, like, do these patients know how long they've been like this?
And it seems like none of them do.
Yeah.
Then, like, De Niro is, like, he does this incredible sequence where, like, he sees himself in the mirror.
Mm-hmm.
And he realizes how old he is.
Mm-hmm. It's a really, really good.
Because his last memory is being 20 years old.
Yeah, yeah. And now he's 50.
Yeah.
And I mean, the scene where like Robin walks in and brings his mom in. I mean, oh my God, that was such a Stewart heartstring pull
big
scene
Stewart
right
scene.
There. I was like, oh God damn it, because they embrace and she immediately like she has her son back. And so, yeah, he then gets approval from the other patrons of the hospital.
Yeah, the patrons. They all fund
all
this.
The benefactors. Yeah,
he makes a video of Leonard.
Yeah,
being like, I've been told I was asleep for a very long time, but I'm back now.
And Leonard quickly kind of like, this isn't really an on-screen moment, I don't believe, but like Leonard quickly kind of falls into this role of like, I realize I am the test subject.
Yes, but he's happy to do it,
and he's happy to do it for all the other patients. And so that he gets the funding to get L-DOPA approved, and he brings back all the other patients. And it's seen as being like this miracle moment. I mean, like, they literally run down his office, knock on his door, be like, Dr. Sayer, it's a miracle. They're all up and walking and talking, and they run into the patient ward, and they're all, like, waking up. And it's quite like an amazing scene to watch. And so then from this point on, we're just getting more like research experiments. Like Robin is asking De Niro to like, I want you to say this phrase out loud, walk from this door to this door. Like he's just kind of testing his mobility stuff. I think the only thing that I can think of next to go to with the plot is they start taking the patients outside to like see different things and view different places. And this is where, you know, we kind of get the thesis of the movie, which is like all these patients who are awake and alive right now are feeling this new breath for life.
Yeah.
That they feel like they know they've been asleep for a long time. How long, they're not totally sure. But now that they feel this like second chance, they're all like feeling this second wind kind of hitting them. Robert De Niro has this really good scene with Robin where he's talking to me like people don't understand how lucky they are to be able to experience and live life. Like when you've been where I've been, and like, I can't remember like the exact quote he says, but he says some degree, it's like, I feel like I've got a second chance at life. And sometimes like everybody needs that. Everybody needs to know what getting a second chance at life feels like. So, and this is shaping Robin's character of being more kind of open to the world around him. So that being said, like I start asking the question as I'm watching this movie, because, you know, you see Robert De Niro.
Yeah.
He's like,
you know how this movie is going to go.
Well, like, you know how this movie is going to go. But like, I wasn't sure in what context it was going to go, because I see Robert De Niro. He's up and walking. He's talking. He's having conversations, and but he's still staying at the mental hospital.
Yeah.
And I start asking myself the question before it comes up with the movie, like, why can't he just like go home?
Why can't he leave?
Why can't he leave? And right as I ask that question, it goes to that scene where Robert De Niro and Robin Williams appears before like the heads of the hospital, including John Hurd.
Yeah.
And asks like, hey, like I want to be able to like get a pass to like go outside and go on a walk.
John Hurd says
no, like you're still under observation and we can't take that liability in the hospital, which is such a weird thing to think about that. Yeah. Like if you go out and something happens, like that's kind of on the hospital's end.
Yeah.
It's like, well, but like, can't, but imagine if they did just say like, okay, you're cured, go out in the world now. And then what would happen?
Yeah.
Like they still need their
medication. He needs the treatments. He needs the medication.
And so, and there's this soul crushing scene where like Robert De Niro wants to leave the hospital, but the guard stops him and says, hey, you can't go any past points. Like, I just want to go on a walk. I just want to go on a walk. And they start having a tussle. The other doctors come in and Robin Williams runs in. It's like, guys, stop it. Like, he's not violent. There's a fun little story in the scene. I think it was this scene where they're trying to restrain him and Robin Williams accidentally slipped his elbow and cracked De Niro's nose. Mm-hmm. And immediately all the crew was like, all right, peace out. Bye.
Yeah, see ya. All right, guys, take five.
Apparently, like he actually broke De Niro's nose back into place from a previous nose breaking injury from Raging Bull.
Yeah.
So he actually straightened it back out. So there was no hard feelings on set after that experience. But
that's a little funny.
Yeah. But yeah, so they won't let Leonard leave.
They won't let Leonard leave. And it becomes clear the drug is starting to
produce symptoms.
Well, the drug is starting to like wear off.
It's not wearing off. This is important. It is producing symptoms. Mm-hmm. There are symptoms of L-DOPA because there have been patients up until 2002 that were still receiving L-DOPA, but the moment they wake up, they get the tics.
Yeah.
This is a symptom of L-DOPA that when they're on it for a long period of time, it starts to overstimulate the brain that gives them their tics and shakes.
Yeah.
So that is what's happening to Leonard. He starts getting these like unrelentless head shakes and hand twitches.
The drug also does stop working.
Well, it's like, I think it's
because
like,
he keeps upping the dosage and nothing's helping.
Yes. This is the confusing part of the movie because the research I read, it's that L-DOPA works, but you need more and more and more. I think it's like a tolerance thing. I think that's what it is.
Yeah.
It's like their bodies build a tolerance to it and you need more to keep them like awake.
Yeah.
But the more you give them, the more the tics are just going to keep happening. So
I do think that if there's a problem with this movie, it's that this is not like super well communicated, this idea, because the if you aren't like locked into the exact structure of things.
Yeah.
Like my read just kind of
is that the drug is just
the drug just stops, which I think works fine for the movie.
It does work fine like for the movie.
The drug just stops working. He tries to increase the dose.
I guess I should be very clear on that. That like for what the movie is trying to persuade, you are correct. But I think for what is factual, like as I said, like in the documentary research that I did on this, it was like there were patients up until like quite recently that were still on L-DOPA.
But Leonard, you know, he starts growing resentful for a little bit. Especially because he had recently just started like a semi-romance with the daughter of another patient in the hospital named Paula.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is kind of taking that from him because he can't stop. twitching in front of her. He isn't allowed to leave the hospital. He's kind of put in a more high security part of the hospital because he tried to leave.
Yeah.
I start growing resentful. But then he starts, you know, realizing that if he only has a little bit of time left, he wants to enjoy it and cherish it while he can.
But also, like, helping Dr. Sayre get as much research.
Because he keeps asking Dr. Sayre, continue to film me. And Robin's just like, I can't. You're like, this is heartbreaking. And he's like, please just film me.
There's a crushing scene where, like, he has like
a full body spasm
seizure. And the only thing that Leonard can say is like, film, 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 like, film me. And Robin gets out the tape, but he's like very much like, this feels really wrong. Yeah. Like this, I don't want to do this. It's like, no, learn.
Yeah.
And this is one of those scenes that like made me choke up a little bit. Cause it's just like Robert De Niro is performing this, like, no, like get what you can out of this. Like, I don't care how this might feel and look, but like, just learn what you can so you can help the others. And so he's filming him degenerating before his very eyes. And I think it sort of hits home for Leonard, as you mentioned, Jeff, that like, he knows he's on borrowed time. He knows this isn't lasting forever. And there's like the final scene with him and Paula in the cafeteria,
which is another example of where I keep bringing up, like, I think this movie's very well calibrated.
Yeah.
That this is, on its face, a very hokey scene.
Yes.
Like, but the movie is smart in that earlier it sets up the specific idea that stimuli of like human touch can, you know, produce reactions with the encephalitis patients.
Yeah.
Like human touch can kind of like break through to them in these moments.
Yeah.
It's very smart to set that up early.
Yeah.
Because you watch the scene and it's like he's, you know,
he's doing all his ticks nervous ticks
and shakes. And then like Paula kind of starts dancing with him and they go away and he's able to dance.
He's able to like it. And
because even the Wikipedia uses the word miraculously, his spasms cease for a brief tender moment, which is like, that would be,
it's a little hokey.
That'd be so hokey if you hadn't done the legwork earlier to set up, credit to Penny Marshall and Steve Zahn, that they set up that human touch like has this effect on these patients.
And also,
so you watch a scene and you're not like, oh my God, this is too much, you know, sugar on the.
But I also want to say the movie doesn't like call very precise attention to the ticks and shakes seizing up.
It doesn't, like, but you do notice that it happens.
You notice it, but if you were filming the scene, like, I want the audience to notice his tics are stopping when they dance, you would be doing like close-ups of his hand calming down. You'd be doing like close-ups.
It's smart to just let it play out. Yeah. It's not a wide shot, but just let it play out in the medium.
Yeah. And it does. Yeah. And it's very effective. And
because like this movie uses filmmaking language smartly, especially in the screenplay, but just in the overarching, you know, how it communicates these ideas.
Yeah.
Because the two of them dance, and he's able to kind of, it's kind of his last thing.
Yeah.
Because the next time we see Leonard, he's fully catatonic again.
Yeah, because Robin goes and sees him, and he's been drawing and coloring with a crayon. Yeah. And then he's Leonard, and he just doesn't move.
Yeah.
He's back into his catatonic.
Because he sees his mom putting a diaper back on him in bed.
Yeah.
That scene
fucking broke me. Mm-hmm. When he's like, literally like, because it's not like a flattering moment. It's just like a full wide body shot.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing him getting a diaper put back on and him in a frozen state in bed.
Yeah.
And the reaction shot on Robin, and then Robin goes and he watches back the tapes. And I think Robin, this is a testament to Robin's performance in this movie. I know we've been talking a lot about De Niro, but like, being that Robin is like the number one on the call sheet for this movie, this is like the scene where Robin really gets to like play with those heartstrings. Because he's watching the tapes of Leonard like awake and fully alive. And I don't think he like fully breaks down per se, but you just see it through his eyes that like he is crushed.
Yeah.
He is like totally
crushed.
He
feels like he failed him.
Yeah.
And
there's a scene where like Leonard even says like, I feel like I failed you.
Yeah.
And he's just like, no. Like, why would you even say something like that? Like, you didn't fail me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really Robin. It's a hard sequence. I think it's why people are always, you know, citing the McConaughey sequence in Interstellar, where he's watching like the tapes of Timothée Chalamet talking to him.
Yeah.
I imagine it's probably hard as an actor to just sit there and watch a thing.
Yeah.
That you know is fake and have a real emotional experience with it.
I mean, like,
because when you're watching a movie and mm-hmm. you cry at a movie, mm-hmm. that's a real emotional reaction you're having. I'm sure Robin, like, he's been palling around with De Niro every day on set.
Yeah.
And now De Niro's not even in the room with him. He's just watching a video.
Yeah.
Of an actor he's been working with. I'm sure it's hard to kind of muster that emotional reaction, but he really goes through the full, like, arc of,
yeah,
you know, guilt, acceptance, and all that. And then it's where I think the movie, like, if there's a moment where it kind of goes a little too far into the melodrama of it.
Yeah.
The next, like, 1-2 punch of, like, because he watches all that, and then Julie Kavner comes in the room, and she comes up and she's like, what's the exact line that she says?
I don't know.
I'm trying to. Oh, she like comes in and is like, yeah, they lived a full life.
Oh, my God.
Well, I can't remember the exact line, but she basically comes in and like kind of is like, no, you didn't. Nothing was, it wasn't taken from them. You like, they had a moment of, you know, life, and we can appreciate that. And,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I think she says like, life is given and taken from everyone.
Mm-hmm. And you gave them like a second.
And you gave them a second chance.
Yeah.
Or you gave them a little bit more of it.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's a kind of a good capstone to the movie.
Yeah.
But then it goes to him giving like a speech to all the patrons.
How do you feel about this scene?
This is what I'm saying. It's like, okay. I feel like you either need the previous bit where it's like Julie Kavner tells him the thesis. You don't need that.
Both.
And then him saying the exact same thing to a room of people who are crying so that you know you need to cry as an audience member.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, a little too far.
Because he even goes as far as say, like, you know, we gave them a second awakening.
Yeah. Here's how I end this movie.
Yeah.
He watches the tape. He cries. Julie Kavner comes in, you know, kind of affirms him for a moment. And then she goes to leave. He kind of sits there for a moment. Turns around, chases her, asks her if she wants to go out for coffee.
Yeah.
That's the end of the movie, if you ask me.
Yeah.
You don't need this little bit of him in between just, you know, being like, to everybody else in this room, this is what we did.
Yeah.
This is the good thing that we did in this movie.
Yeah, I don't Awakenings. Think I don't think you needed this
1990
scene.
Directed by Penny Martin. You're like, all right, wrong. Like,
the movie ends with like, it cuts back to Robin and Robert De Niro, and they're doing like, they've been doing these experiments through like
Paula
a Ouija
still
board.
Comes to see him. Robin finally gets the courage to ask Julie Kavner out on a date.
Mm-hmm.
They go to Lard Lad Donuts in Springfield.
Stop.
A very good actress who I'm only able to see as Marge Simpson.
Yeah. But it cuts to like Robin and Robert De Niro. Like they're back doing more like experiments to test out to see like how much consciousness is there. And then we get that biopic text at the very end of...
we get the classic biopic ending.
Yeah. And it says like all the patients that were awakened then went back into their frozen catatonic state. And that Dr. Oliver Sacks is still working at a hospital in New York or in the Bronx to this day. And that's where the movie ends. Cut to credits.
Yeah, cut to credits. Slipknot starts playing. No.
So, but yeah, this movie comes out. And first off, I'll just say like up the bat, like I love this movie. I think I was a little skeptical of it at first going in, like any kind of hospital drama, especially from our Extraordinary Measures talk, being like, how much is this going to sugarcoat, you know, the griminess of what actually probably happened. And I don't feel like it sugarcoated that much for me. Like, I think it went through all like the painful, raw moments that it needed to. And because it did that, like I really felt everything this movie was trying to like convey. Yeah,
I think it works.
I cried twice. Very heartfelt movie. Mm-hmm. Very Stewart movie. Highly recommend. But this movie comes out. It's released on December 22nd, 1990. and it does fairly well. Like, I think it gets like modestly pretty good reviews.
It makes $108 million.
Yeah, off a $22 million budget, which is
nuts.
Yeah, it's for this type of movie, absolutely. Granted, you always got to look at through the rose-colored lens of the 90s that movies like this were like had a shot at making a good profit. But this movie is running off the accolades of Robin and De Niro. Yeah. De Niro gets an Oscar nomination for this role, which of course he would.
I mean, do you know the thing about his Oscar nomination in this movie, though?
No.
That's funny.
No.
I didn't say the thing. Is because he's in this. And he gets the nomination for this. He is not in contention for Goodfellas. Because everyone's always like, why is De Niro not nominated for an Oscar for Goodfellas?
Because of this
It's
movie?
Because he was in Awakenings. And that was his Oscar play
damn.
This year.
Okay. Okay.
It's a little funny.
Yeah. But this movie does get fairly good reviews. Yeah. It
gets nominated for Best Picture, Best Actor, and Best Screenplay. Yep. All of which I think are pretty deserving.
Yes.
This is the same. It gets nominated for Best Picture along this year. This is just like a fun lineup of Best Picture nominees. It's Dances with Wolves, which goes on to win, Awakenings, Ghost, The Godfather Part 3, and Goodfellas.
Yeah,
which is a fun lineup.
I want to play one more clip of Robin talking about this movie.
Yes,
on the Johnny Carson show.
But there's sometimes where you have to break the mood because we're working in a mental hospital for 5 months in Brooklyn, and every day you'd walk in, there'd be a little guy. Staring, there'd be like, there's, you know, there's a lot of doors and only 5 keys. And you'd be there and you'd walk past and there'd be a guy waiting at the window going, do I look nuts to you? Do I look nuts to you? Do I look crazy to you? And you realize it was one of the doctors. This is the beginning. So you're walking into this environment and we're working in this place. Yeah. And it was a hospital where the bottom two floors were still real patients.
Yeah.
And we used a lot of real patients. We used, Penny was using schizophrenics and Tourette's patients. And it was a weird thing. The schizophrenics, she would direct them, and everything was fine until the moment when they said, it's time now. We're going to have to, because someone's talking in front of you. We want you to talk but not say anything. And all of a sudden you saw them look like, and I'm crazy?
Yeah. they wanted background stuff, but not...
It was that moment where all of a sudden reality went...
Yeah.
But yeah, I just wanted to point that out, that they used actual patients as background for this movie because they filmed in a real hospital.
Yeah.
We'll have a few other final notes to say, but one quick little tidbit tangent I wanted to go on about regarding this movie, because I think I had to watch this with the understanding background that Robin Williams in towards the end of his life would get misdiagnosed with Parkinson's, which we would later find out after his suicide that he would actually had a form of Lewy bodies dementia. And it was one of those things that when I was watching this movie and they were talking about like these patients who they thought either they had a special form of Parkinson's or they thought, oh, well, they're just in a catatonic state from schizophrenia or something. And they're like, no, like these people have a very specific neurodegenerative disease that could be treated if we did the right things for them. I don't know. I just wanted to bring that up because like a lot of people will say, actually, funny enough, we talked about Bobcat Goldthwait or we will talk about Bobcat Goldthwait next week on Shakes the Clown. We'll talk about him next week, but something that I already know about, Bobcat is that he'll go on many different podcast shows and talk about Robin's end of life. And he'll say, you know, the whole like suicide depression narrative is not accurate.
Yeah.
That he had a neurodegenerative disease that made him, become less and less aware of his reality.
Yeah.
The problem with Lewy body dementia is you start noticing these like neurodegenerative symptoms, like you go into these catatonic frozen states and then you would come out of them. And the biggest thing about Lewy body's dementia that I want to be very careful and make sure I'm not misrepresenting the disease is that as opposed to dementia and Alzheimer's, with Lewy body's dementia, you are slightly more aware of your degenerative state, which is what makes it kind of worse. Is that you can feel yourself getting worse, but you can't do anything about it. And that kind of correlates more to like Robin's end of life. So I don't know. I brought that up because, like, as I'm watching this movie, yeah. like that is kind of in the,
yeah,
back
the back
of my
of your mind.
Mind. Through that, which may have been why, like, this movie was that much more, like, effective for me.
Yeah, because, like, Robin goes through something similar in his life.
Yeah, he goes through a misunderstood diagnosis where had he been properly diagnosed, not to say, like, things would have been different, but maybe he would have gotten a more effective way of treatment. Because they treated him for Parkinson's, which doesn't really do that much for Lewy body's dementia.
Yeah.
Which is the sad fact of it. Mm-hmm. So anyway, the movie's great.
No, good movie.
A lot of people still like it. And I don't know. Do you have anything else to say about Awakenings?
It's very effective movie. In regards to, like, medical dramas of this nature, it's in the upper echelon.
Such a hard genre.
Treats its subject
well.
With respect and... Yeah. It's good.
Yeah, I agree with what you were saying earlier. It's such a hard genre.
Roger Ebert was frustrated with this movie's Oscar nominations. He gave this movie a 4 out of 4, to be clear, and it led him to read the book. But he was annoyed because he thought Robin had the better performance of the two, that he has the harder task.
I agree that Robin had the harder role to play, but it's the My Left Foot nomination, man.
Yeah.
You're going to give the nomination to the guy, like... I hate to say this crudely, but, like, you're going
to
give
the nomination to the guy who's doing the ticks.
Yeah, that's how it's going to go. Terry Gilliam even told Robin Williams in this movie, it's like, you know, like, De Niro's probably going to get the nomination and you're not. And it's because they always give it to the guy with the ticks.
Yeah.
That being said, like, this is another chapter in Robin's, like, New York era. And the next big project, we have 2 episodes coming up next week. We're joined by a very special guest. Talk about the Citizens Kane of alcoholic clown movies, Shakes the Clown. So you're in for a special treat with that one. After that, we'll talk about a little interlude, Kenneth Branagh film called Dead Again. And then we get to what I think would be known as, like, the last New York project that Robin was going to be signed up for, The Fisher King. Directed by Terry Gilliam, which I'm very looking forward to talking about that movie. Yeah. I've heard really great things about it. And so those are all my final thoughts. Anything else before I take us home, Jeff?
No, I think that's it. See you next week for Shakes the Clown next week.
If you like this episode, please remember to rate, review, comment, like, and subscribe.
Did you say Fisher King next week?
No, Shakes the Clown.
Okay, Shakes the Clown next
Shakes
week.
The Clown.
I
just said, like, I outlined, like, we're doing Shakes the Clown next week, and then after that we'll be doing Dead Again, and then we'll do The Fisher King, which is, like, the big main last tentpole of Robin's New York era. So if you like this episode, remember to rate, review, comment, like, subscribe, whatever platform you're listening on. Remember, we are on pretty much whatever podcast platform you could think of. Spotify is typically our big one, but you can also find us on Apple Podcast. We still do YouTube, but that's pretty irregular, and we keep getting angry comments about
people thinking
you're going to watch the full movie.
No, like, if you're listening to this on YouTube, you know. Yeah.
Anyway, special thanks to Rebecca for the graphic design, and special thanks to Michael Van Bodegem Smith for the theme music that is now taking you all out. See you all next week for Shakes the Clown.